You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very much for coming. It's lovely to see a full room. Today's speaker is Ashton Applewhite, who I've just met upstairs, and she is utterly delightful and looks very good for her age. I have to say that. You say, well, you look good for your weight. Ashton is an author and activist and has been recognised by the New York Times, National Public Radio, which you must know if you've got an interesting and curious mind, and the American Society on Ageing as an expert on ageism. So we have a big thing in common there. I'm not saying I'm an expert, but Ashton blogs as This Chair Rocks, which is, I think, is a great title. I wish I'd thought of it. She speaks widely and has written for Harper's and Playboy, and is the I'm going to make a complete hash of this now, and is the voice of Yo, Is This Ageist? She says in received pronunciation. In 2015, she was included in Salt Magazine's list of the world's 100 inspiring women. That's quite an accolade, along with Arundhati Roy, Aung San Suu Kyi, Naomi Klein, and other remarkable activists who are committed to social change. Now, me, I'm what you might describe as Ashton Light. I wrote a book that is where Ashton's gives you a huge, broad scope and is kind of the widescreen version. My book is, I brought it down because what happened to me at the time I was pitching the book was what happens to a lot of women in their 50s, where they get caught at both ends of the care spectrum, ageism in the workplace, and all the rest of it. So that became the structure on which I hung my points, which are similar to Ashton's, but of course apply to, mostly to the UK. But there are interesting parallels with experiences on both sides of the pond. I write for The Guardian. I wrote a column called The Vintage Years for The Guardian. I didn't think of the title, they did. And I write for New Statesman. I write for Standard Issue. I write for The Pool. And I have done some work on BBC radio and TV talking about ageism, also about domestic abuse. Anyway, without further ado, I give you Ashton Applewhite.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you to the RSA. Thank you to my friend Elizabeth Varley, who midwifed this event, and to all of you for showing up. I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to give about a 15-minute talk, 15 to 20 minutes, and then there'll be a Q&A because I cover sort of the basic story of how I came to be doing what I'm doing, so which basically sprang out of the realization that it doesn't make much sense to pretend that something that is very definitely happening to you is never going to happen to you, but that is how most of us behave when it comes to getting older. And I think the most common thing you hear people say about it with this tone of sort of sad resignation is, well, it beats the alternative, which I thought was an okay thing to say until it dawned on me that it really means that the only thing worse than being old is being dead. And I used to feel that way too. That was when old to me meant sad and sick. And I didn't really want to think about it much. When it crossed my mind, I flipped the channel. But then I started a project called So When Are You Going to Retire? Inspired by my partner's parents, and began interviewing people over 80 who work and learning about longevity. And finding older people to talk to was incredibly easy. They were interesting. They were doing all sorts of interesting things, working class, professional. And people were always saying, oh, you should meet the guy who sells ices in the park, or my Aunt Lucille, or my accountant. But this, and it didn't surprise me that they were incredibly diverse and in the world in very interesting ways. But what did surprise me was this gap, this discrepancy that began to emerge between what I had simply assumed it would be like to be that old and the reality. So why the disconnect? What were some of my grim assumptions about what the future held? Well, the grimmest was that I would end my days drooling under a bad Van Gogh print in some ghastly institutional hallway. And in fact, the percentage of Americans over 65 in nursing homes is 4%, and it's dropping. It's down from 5 in the last decade. Over half, these statistics, by the way, are all U.S. statistics, although the book draws heavily on U.K. data as well. So over half of the oldest old, which is 85 and up, can go about their everyday lives without any personal assistance. So another preconception, dementia lurks. So if you subtract that 4% of the Americans over 65, 90% of the remainder is cognitively fit. Alzheimer's is a terrible disease. We don't know how it works. We aren't anywhere near a cure, and we may not find a cure, but it is not typical of aging. The real epidemic is anxiety over memory loss. At the other end of the spectrum, about 20% of people seem to escape cognitive decline entirely. Think about it, right? We all know some of those super sharp 90-year-olds. Most of us will experience some decline in specific abilities, memory processing, you know, that damn tip of the tongue thing. But the brain of a healthy older person can do just about everything a healthy younger person can do. It just takes a little longer, and new data shows that it's because we have more data to sift through. Another assumption, old people don't have sex. Well, sexual activity does tend to decline with age, but my 74-year-old friend Robin is having the best sex of her life, and she is not an anomaly. Retirement homes are hotbeds of romance. Thank you, Viagra. People who make sex a priority and embrace a broader notion of the forms it can take, think slow, whole body, playful, can enjoy deeply satisfying sex for as long as we want. I also assumed that old people were depressed because, duh, they were old and they were going to die soon. It turns out that people are happiest at the beginnings and the ends of their lives. It's called the U-curve of happiness, and it's been borne out by study after study in the U.S. and around the world. It obtains independent of economic status and marital status. So, and it's because as we turn 80, we get better at dealing with negative emotions like anger and envy and fear. You don't have to be a Buddhist or a bodhisattva or a billionaire to experience these changes. The aging process itself confers them on the healthy brain. And that is the neurological underpinnings of that curve. So slowly, skeptically, gears grinding, my point of view began to shift. I realized that old age was almost certainly going to be different and way better than the grim slide into depression, dementia, and puffy white shoes of my nightmares, although I am still worried about the shoes. And that was before I had to go see a podiatrist. So why the disconnect? How come these facts take so many people by surprise? Because of ageism, treating people differently on the basis of how old we think they are. It is the last socially sanctioned prejudice, right? We don't like it when people make sexist or racist comments, right? But who even blinks when older people are described as foolish or feeble or even repulsive? And we experience ageism anytime someone assumes we're too old for something, a task, a relationship, a haircut, or too young. Instead of finding out who we really are and what we're capable of. Ageism is to age what racism is to race. Both are socially constructed ideas that change over time and that serve a social and economic purpose. They are not about how we look. They are about what people in power want how we look to mean. Stereotyping underlies ageism, as it does all isms, the assumption that all members of a group are the same. It is ageist to assume that all olders are wise or frail or that kids are like that because ageism cuts both ways. Ageism is why people think that everyone in a retirement home is the same age. That would be old, even though residents can span four decades. So imagine thinking that way about a group of people from 20 to 60. That never happens. It is why the last box on those marketing checklists, you know, like 18 to 26 and then 27 to 34, they stop at 65, as though everyone over 65 does the same thing and buys the same crud. I turned 64 2 days ago, so I'm just teetering. And you're lucky you caught me on my last year of being a viable person in the world. Stereotypes are always a mistake, but especially when it comes to age, because the older we get, the more different from one another we become. That's a social, biological, physical fact. And it's why geriatricians say, if you've seen one 80-year-old, you've seen one 80-year-old. People aren't born ageist, but it starts in early childhood, around the same time that attitudes about race and gender start to form. That's a real ad. Kids are exposed to negative stereotypes about aging all the time, from ads for wrinkle creams to children's books, you know, that have the passive granny or the evil crone and not much in between. Older people can be the most ageist of all because we have had a lifetime to internalize these stereotypes and we've never questioned them. Like everyone else, I internalized these prejudices without realizing it. I had to acknowledge it and confront them. Senior moment quips, for example, I stopped making them when it dawned on me that when I lost the car keys in high school, I didn't call it a junior moment. You hear people say, I don't feel old all the time. What they really mean is, I don't feel ugly, or useless, or helpless, or any of the other bad things for which old has become an all-purpose placeholder. And we experience those feelings all our lives, right? They're not a function of age. You can feel that at 13 as easily as at 93. Ageism is why teenagers get no respect, and why 20-somethings who aren't having peak lives every minute feel overwhelmed, and why 30-year-old women freak out about getting over the hill, and why 40-year-olds can't get job interviews. Ageism affects everyone. We are all worried about some aspect of getting older, and those fears are legitimate and real. This is not a feel-good book that says everything about getting old is just, you know, easy as pie. But what never dawns on most of us is that the fears are fears of aging, whether getting sick or running out of money or ending up alone, can be better or worse depending on the society in which we age, right? And this one, this culture, is grotesquely youth-centric, and it amplifies those anxieties. Ageism feeds on denial. Our reluctance to admit that we will get old, that we are aging. It is denial when old pals cringe at public mention of how long we've known each other instead of delighting in it. It is denial when people bridle at being politely offered a seat on the bus. It is denial when we snap up products that tout their anti-aging properties or promise agelessness. Aging means living, and living means aging. If you're not aging, you're dead. Denial blinds us to ageism in ourselves and perpetuates it in a thousand different ways. When we see people as other than us, right, other nationality, other religion, you know, even a sports team, then their well-being starts to seem less of a human right. And that is why, one reason why, 5 out of 6 incidents of elder abuse go unreported. That's in the U.S. I don't know what it's like here, but I'd hazard a guess that it's not a lot better. We don't talk about elder abuse, and neither do many victims who are embarrassed by their vulnerability and ashamed to talk about it, and ashamed to ask for help because they think they may not deserve it. That is internalized ageism at work, right? When you hear all these messages your whole life long that your older self is less valuable than your younger one, and it becomes part of your own identity. And when people don't ask for help and call out abuse, that reinforces the structural discrimination that makes it a problem in the first place. When labels are hard to read, or handrails are missing, or containers are hard to open, we think, I should be more limber, or I should be stronger, or I should be better prepared. We think those obstacles are our fault instead of the result of lousy design or crappy public policy. Aging is an accomplishment, but in this culture, we're conditioned to feel shame instead of pride. This paves the way for a host of unhealthy behaviors, from denial to contempt. That's what's going on when people refuse to use walkers or wheelchairs because the stigma is so great, even when the alternative is never leaving home. We blame our own aging, our failure to age successfully. Don't get me started on that. Instead of confronting the ageism that makes these barriers acceptable and these natural transitions shameful, it is not loving a man that makes life harder for gay guys. It's homophobia. It's not having a vagina that makes life harder for women. It's sexism. And it is not the passage of time that makes aging so much harder than it should be. It is ageism. But until feminism taught us new scripts, women blamed themselves for second-class status instead of systematic discrimination. There is enormous overlap between ageism and sexism. Surprise. Also with ableism, although denial makes us act as though people with disabilities never get old and old people never get disabled. The more clearly we see these social forces at work in ourselves and in the world at large, the easier it is to envision alternative, more positive, more accurate narratives. The longer we wait to challenge them, the more damage it does to ourselves, our sense of self, and our place in the world. A growing body of evidence shows that attitudes towards aging have an actual measurable effect on how our minds and bodies function at the cellular level. There's no inherent reason for the effect to be negative, but an ageist culture tells us that wrinkles are ugly and that old people are incompetent and that it's sad to be old. And when we assimilate those stereotypes, they become part of our identity, and that influences how our brains and bodies function. My favorite experiment is where scientists primed a bunch of college students with negative age stereotypes, words like forgetful, Florida, and bingo. I don't know what they'd swap out in the UK for Florida, but I'm sure there's something. So they flashed the terms too quickly on a computer screen for people to be conscious of them. And then they measured the speed at which that group of students and the control group walked to the elevator. And the group that had been negatively primed walked more slowly. So these are 18-year-olds, right? Imagine the effect on older people for whom the terms are more relevant and therefore, of course, more likely to become self-fulfilling prophecies for no good reason. People with more positive feelings about aging behave differently from those convinced that getting older means becoming irrelevant or pathetic. They do better on memory tests, and they have better handwriting, which is an indicator of neurological well-being. They can walk faster and are more likely to recover fully from severe disability. And they live longer, and not just a little bit, an average of 7.5 years longer. So everyone agrees, whether you love old people or hate old people, that health has the biggest effect on how we age and how much it costs. So think what a national anti-ageism campaign, which HelpAge International is starting to inaugurate worldwide in the fall, so think what that would do to extend not just lifespan, but health span. The workplace is where many people, men in particular, first become aware of age discrimination. And workers at both ends of the spectrum face discrimination, which is really important to remember in terms of the hideous response to the Brexit vote. You know, economic inequity affects everyone. It doesn't break down by generations, and I'm happy to talk more about that. So millennials, in the U.S. at least, are criticized for having no work ethic and needing their hands held, and they have trouble getting a foothold. And in Silicon Valley, engineers are getting Botox and hair transplants before key interviews. And these are educated, skilled white guys in their 30s. So imagine the effect further down the food chain. Older people are damned if we work for taking jobs away from younger people, even though that is a fallacy. Google lump of labor. The amount of work labor is not fixed, blah, blah, blah. And we are damned if we don't work for mooching off younger workers. And we're really damned if we're laid off because experience is a liability in an ageist world. Longer lives require working longer and saving more, but age discrimination on the workplace is on the rise. Workers at the top of their game find themselves unceremoniously shown the door, perhaps after being treated differently from younger colleagues or excluded from key meetings. And it is incumbent on workers of all ages to keep up with technology and social media and to keep an open mind. Your boss may be younger than your granddaughter, but it doesn't mean she has nothing to teach you. And it is just as important to call out discrimination when we encounter it and question the rationales that employers use to justify it. That older workers are less productive, less dependable, less committed, less teachable, or less creative, and those are only a few. Not one of these stereotypes holds up under scrutiny, and it's often balanced out. I mean, older workers might hurt themselves, might take longer to recuperate from an injury, and of course, very little of the workforce nowadays is even involved in jobs that involve physical labor, much less than used to be the case, but they hurt themselves less often, right? So it evens out. Push back, and we transform the landscape into a more equitable one for workers of all ages. Right, the flex time, the accommodations also benefit caregivers, people caregiving for older or younger people, families, students, anyone looking for work-life, you know, balance in this always-on era. The more flexible arrangements required by older workers also benefit students, families, caregivers. It drives me nuts when some clown calls me young lady and expects me to feel complimented, but I didn't know why until I started thinking deeply about it. Because it's embarrassing to be called out as older until we quit being embarrassed about it. And it's not healthy to go through life dreading our futures. Everyone wakes up a day older. The sooner we accept that, the sooner we move from denial to acceptance, and maybe even all the way to embrace, the better off we'll be. That's when we throw off what geriatrician Bill Thomas calls the tyranny of still. The delusion that as long as we're still running up the stairs or still driving or still dating younger women, whatever, you know, we all have our stills, we could stop the clock, as if that would be a good thing. Why on earth do we stop celebrating personal growth, the incredibly important ability to adapt to and change from life all our lives until we hit sort of late middle age, whatever muddly stage my interlocutor is in? Of course, I'm beyond that now, thank heavens, because I'm so much older. But, you know, it's a dumb goal, and it's punitive, because everything changes. We all age at different rates, socially, mentally, and physically. It's why it's important to tell the truth if someone asks your age, but it's also important to ask what difference that number makes, right? To push back against the idea that that number has some fixed meaning, because the older we get, the less reliable an indicator it is of pretty much anything about a person. I am 64. I know I'm not young. I don't see myself as old, and I know an awful lot of people feel the same way. So we're in the grips of this cruel paradox, right? We aspire to grow old. Do you know anyone who wants to die young? And yet, we dread the prospect. So we spend a lot of energy sustaining the illusion that the old are somehow not us. That's the denial thing. And that's why I've become an old person in training. A phrase I appropriated from geriatrician Joanne Lynn. So becoming an old person in training bridges that us-them divide, right? It loosens the grip of that exhausting illusion. You can sort of slip off that hamster wheel of pretending that you can prevent something inevitable and powerful from happening. So it means ditching preconceptions, looking at and listening to the olders around us with an open mind, and re-envisioning our place among them. The sooner we make this imaginative leap, the better. All change starts with awareness. Unlearning is hard. It is not easy to undo beliefs we've held all our lives, especially when they involve looking at your own bias. It's uncomfortable. The women's movement called it consciousness raising. Think of it as a mindset alteration. Some places to start: look for ways in which you are ageist instead of for evidence that you're not. You can't challenge bias unless you're aware of it, and everyone is biased some of the time. I catch myself thinking ageist stuff all the time. Talk to people significantly older and younger than you, and listen carefully. If you don't know many, seek them out. It's really important to have friends of all ages. The next time you wonder whether an outing or an outfit or an attitude is age appropriate, reconsider the question. There is no such thing. What would a truly intergenerational world look like? How could we work together to bring it about? Change ripples outward when we point out ageist behaviors and beliefs in the world around us. Without being a jerk about it, that's the hard part. Because if you just confront someone, then they just resist. But if you can get them to think for a minute about why they said what they said, then people learn, hopefully. So train yourself to notice when everyone in a group is the same age. And unless there's a really good reason, speak up about it. Assume capacity, not incapacity. Don't assume someone is too old or too young to weigh in on a topic or take on a responsibility. If you're feeling ambitious, start a consciousness-raising group. This powerful tool catalyzed the women's movement in the 70s, and what it did was it made women realize that the problems they were facing, you know, that they didn't feel like they could get ahead in the world or, an identity, or they thought that, material possessions would, give them what they needed. Once they got together in consciousness-raising meetings and shared notes, they saw that these were widely shared problems. Right, that required a collective political solution. And that's where we need to go with our thoughts about getting older. And brief promo, if you go to thischairrocks.com, there's a resources button, and there's a PDF for a brochure called Who Me, Ageist? How to Start a Consciousness-Raising Group Around Age Bias. Changing the culture is a tall order, and you all at the RSA know that. You hear people say, "Don't call me old," all the time. Or stuff like, "My mom's 94, but she's not old." Someone said that to me recently. But culture is far from fixed. Look at gender, right? Western culture used to view it as a rigid binary, and we understand now that it is far more fluid. So if gender can be conceived of this way, why on earth not age, which is obviously intrinsically a spectrum? There is no line in the sand, no crossover between old and young, after which it's all downhill. You know, and as we get older, we know this. We know it intuitively. Let's call it out. What does experience tell you? Anyone else in the room have any fun over 40? Working together, we can overturn the grotesque notion that two-thirds of life is decline. Expect pushback. Social change unsettles. It's worth it. What kind of a world do we want to grow old in? And for our children and grandchildren, who may well live to be 100, to inherit? If marriage equality is here to stay, why not age equality? If gay pride has gone mainstream and millions of people now take pride in identifying as disabled, why not age pride? The only reason that idea sounds outlandish is this is the first time you've encountered it. It won't be the last. Longevity is here to stay. Everyone is aging. It's time to end ageism, and it's time for a radical aging movement. Thank you.
I'm going to leap up a step to show my knees have still got it.
There we go.
Thank you very much.
No shame that was asking for help up the steps. God knows. I learned getting here from the subway, the tube.
Yes, it's no good
it's
if
like,
you.
Oh yes, I'll just ask some hefty Brit to carry up my suitcase, and he did, and he was happy to do it.
He was surprised to be asked, probably, because we do all sort of struggle on a bit.
But then you get a big smile. When you
that's
do ask,
true. Yes.
It's shocking how much courage it takes to ask. That's the crazy part.
People kind of like to feel appreciated, and doing something for somebody else, makes you feel appreciated, doesn't it?
Very much so.
One of the things that right at the beginning, you talked about stats for nursing homes and 4% in the entire US.
Entire population 65 and up.
65 and up.
And declining.
I was interested by that when I was reading your book, and there's so much in there where you go, oh yes,
over and over,
and I thought, well, I wonder what ours are. So first of all, I had a job to find it, because I do envy you your great body of literature about growing older, because I remember this from researching my own book, that most of what I looked at was American, because you can't get it in this country in any kind of accessible form. You've either got very dry academic papers, or you've got something that is a bit twee and patronising, and you don't want to read it. But anyway, I envy you that.
That's why they have us,
yes. But I found on Age UK's updated statistics, they were updated in May, so only a month old, that in the UK, and the nearest equivalent I could find was people over 85 plus, which incorporates your group, mm-hmm. but would, so I imagine you would
and
make
still,
it more.
20 years beyond my age.
The percentage is 16%, which is four times as many. Are we doing that here? It stayed reasonably static since 2001, which is a relief. But we do get a lot of this in the media about care costs and how much it's going to cost to care for your parents, how much of a sap on the economy caring for older people is.
Right.
And yet there is this brilliant statistic. But we seem to be much worse than you. So.
Well, it's a bit apples and oranges, because you would need the statistic for the number of people 85 and up. I mean, I don't actually think 14% is that low.
But your 65 plus would incorporate the 85 plus, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but it's a bigger population group. All these statistics are double-edged, because, you know, aging is living. The same, you know, say your age, but push back against what it means is a classic one. The whole idea of living, aging in place, staying in place, it's a huge movement in the U.S. It's, when I first heard what huge percent, I think it's 3/4 of women 75 and older live alone in the United States. When I encountered that beginning of my research, I'm like, isn't that great? They're all independent. Well, a lot of them are also poor and isolated. And one reason the living in place movement in the U.S. is getting a ton of momentum is two reasons. There's money to be made in making new, you know, housing arrangements for, I'm dead center of the baby boom, you know, so there's an economic opportunity, and it saves the government money if they can send in an aide to you 4 to 8 hours a day, it's much cheaper for them than putting you in a nursing home. So all these things need to be looked at in context. And again, as each older person ages, I mean, most people want to stay in their homes, but typically that means not having a whole lot of social contact, especially in the U.S. where people are isolated and reliant on cars. So it's not the, you know, it embodies a lot of, it can embody age denial. It's a way to stay in your house so you can pretend that you are never going to need all the systems of support that you will need in order to stay in your home and age in society, in age in community is
there
the term
is
I like.
There's a bit of a stigma attached to, especially to women living on their own. They think we must be really, I
don't
do
get
it.
Cats.
And I've got two. I took one in this week. And I don't care. And my name's Helen and I'm 60 in the spirit of things. There is a stigma attached to that as well, where you might be perfectly happy, but people think, oh dear, you poor thing, you know, you live on your own. One of the things that I've noticed, talking about where people live and needing transport and things, is that when I moved out of London, and I moved out of London because of workplace ageism, that is, I took redundancy with the idea that I would move on to the next stage of my career, thinking I would take a part-time job, and then part-time jobs for 50-plus, women aged 50-plus in London are apparently non-existent. I was told they were looking for someone more up and coming. Somebody as opposed to someone been and gone. Yeah. When I went for a part-time job to a sort of semi-retired chairman, but there you go. But what I found when I moved out was that there were all these old people suddenly in this village where I've moved to and in the local town. All these old people walking around and no one's abusing them, nobody's being rude to them, where I've been shouted at several times in the street in London. And it then occurred to me that I didn't see very many older people when I was living in London because they're all being, as are the younger people, it's working at both,
it's economic.
Being pushed out into the... We're being segregated. Segregation isn't the way. Integration is the way.
As with race, as with, you know... I mean, that's the most obvious way to get beyond this us-them divide, because when you have personal contact with someone who is different from you in whatever way, you can't help but see them as an individual because you're having a conversation with them, and then it shifts. You can't, you know, your stereotype... The U.S. is incredibly age segregated. I have these sort of, you know, idealistic visions of the British pub where everyone, you know, gets together in all ages. And rural life, you know, is much more congenial to, you know, and village life. Now we're getting really pastoral and, you know, unrealistic. But, of course, where people of all ages do live together and people have their natural, you know, positions in the community, then no one becomes useless and no one falls off the cliff. And we understand that people of all different ages have different sets of abilities. You know, I mean, the idea that disability is just something that happens when you're old, for example, is wrong. There's plenty of younger people with disabilities and older people who stay healthy. Age is not a good vector.
Carry on with the sort of segregation, discrimination thing, fashion, which you talk about in your book. We don't want fashion that is labelled 50 plus.
I don't even know what that means.
No, well, anybody get the Radio Times and you get those lovely leaflets that come in with live young women of 30 modelling clothes that are clearly meant for older women.
Well, movements need... actions.
Yes.
So let's organize.
Oh, we've tried. I've had them on Twitter and they've not gone for it at all. They took exception.
But keep doing it. And when people don't want to, I mean, people need to look at their own reasons for resistance to these ideas, whether it's not wanting to appear foolish or being invisible. I mean, it's incumbent on us, and I like the way we're not waving each other's books, but in your book you talk about, you know, feeling invisible at, there we go, the invisible woman. I think this is true, and you guys can throw tomatoes at me from the back row if you think I'm crazy. I think we are only invisible if we allow ourselves to feel invisible. And I'm not doing that. I'm just not, you know. And I mean, I one of the things, fashion always gets a dozen, you know, million retweets or whatever. Another thing, when we dye our hair to cover the gray, and when we lie about our ages, I really, really understand the reasons why we do these things. It is almost a necessity if we want to hold on to a job or get hits on a dating site, because the objective is to look young, even though there's no such thing as looking young. So I understand the strategies, but it is like a person of color attempting to pass as white, or someone who's queer attempting to pass as straight. It's not good for us, and it deflects attention away from the discrimination that makes these strategies necessary. And I had this great idea, and I know the world isn't ready for it yet, but what if everyone who dyes their hair to cover the gray and hates doing it. I mean, I have brown hair, but I dyed it white, and now it's sort of growing out. But what if we had the year of letting our hair go gray? And the world saw how many of us there are and how beautiful we are. That would change things, you know? And I know we're not ready, but it's like, do not agree to be silent. And do not accept this notion of yourself as invisible. I mean, I know that's easy to say. I know it's a big internal ask, but it's got to start there.
It's a difficult thing to do. I agree. You get tired by it. I felt a bit battle-scarred and weary when I came out of London because I've been fighting it for so long. Also, it's very hard to get things into the media about older people. Mm-hmm. If I had a pound for every pitch that, oh, no, because it's older women.
But you know. I think, and, you know, there will be a Q&A any minute now.
Yes,
where one of the wonderful things about the Amazon responses to my book, which is a manifesto, it is a call for action, have been that younger people are reading it and that people say it is a book for all ages.
Yes.
The sooner we become an old person in training and challenge this idea that uselessness and ugliness lies ahead, then that's where we undermine it. And if younger people will join in that struggle, then we get around the whole age apartheid
start
business.
Start with your own children, I think.
Yeah.
Right, Q&A. This lady at the end who's magnificently grey.
I've actually been grey since in my 30s, and I have had people who, when I was younger, who complained at me as to why I dyed my hair white, and why didn't I just wait till I was older. So I've actually never dyed it, but I'm interested because a lot of young people now are dyeing their hair grey, and it's really fascinating to see, you know, that they are emulating us. I also wanted to add to you to the discussion about nursing homes. In America, there are enormous numbers of not-for-profit places where the elderly can go. So they will sell up their home and buy into those, which means that they're living in their own apartment, because it's an apartment of... It's no bigger than the place I live. It's a bedroom, a sitting room, bathroom, and the kitchen is part of the sitting room. And they can join in or not join in. Usually the evening meal is, and you pay a certain amount for this, but they sold their home and used their used that to buy into this. And if they need care, then they can move up a floor and get care. And I know this because my mother-in-law lived in one of those until she was 98. And I think she got younger at 85 when she moved into that. No, I mean mentally younger. She was really?
Youngness is not an option.
Well, okay, but I have to say that some of the best dinner parties, so to speak, I have ever been to were with those old people and sitting around tables with them. And there's one particular one, because you'd mentioned about sex, was an elderly lady who happened actually to have quite a few difficulties, but not in any way in her brain. And someone asked her, so she was in her 90s, and someone asked her, did she have any regrets about her really, you know, her life sounded really interesting. So this is a younger woman of 93 asking a woman of 95 whether she had any regrets in her life. And she said, yes, just one, that when her husband died, she didn't take a toy boy. And I just thought that was brilliant. But so I think it's really a question of how your comparison is, that in America there are much better deals for the elderly than there are in the UK.
Hello, you talked a lot of great sense, but I talk as an 86-year-old founder of an organisation in this country called Growing Old Disgracefully, which is about breaking the stereotype of not being invisible. And I want to tell you something I heard on the radio last night. It's a programme we have here called The Moral Maze, and this was about the referendum. And one of the young people, the 35-year-olds, propounded the idea that people over 65 should not have the vote. People who are unemployed shouldn't have the vote. And this was handed down. But this fits in with your story about ageism. That is being said in this country very severely. We're being blamed all the time. Yeah, yeah. I was blamed in the street on Friday, and I went out wearing my Remain sticker still, and a young man accosted me and said, "Sorry, dearie," that's the first ageism bit, "sorry, dearie, you're too late. We're going to get rid of all these bloody foreigners." So that's the ageism and the racism combined. But I want to go on to say that I'm also a member of an organisation called Older Women's Co-Housing, which answers all the questions you say about old people being alone and invisible. In this country, we're the first organisation in this country to do this. And it's for women over 55. We have individual accommodation, and we look after each other.
Yes.
And we manage it ourselves. That's a way for the future. There's not just the choice of residential or dying in your own home. A lot of things have been done in this country, but we need to speak up.
The women's co-housing thing is a great initiative. I think more common in London.
I think two points about the Brexit vote. One is that all these forms of discrimination intersect, of course. And when we work against ageism, we are also inherently working against sexism and against all these forces that divide us and segregate us and pit us against each other. So any time you hear about old versus young, it's not unlike the Marxist argument. You know, if the Polish workers are fighting the black factory workers, no one is striking against the management for a better living wage, which is the underlying issue. It's the same with old versus young. You hear it in the U.S. around health care. We have enough money for little babies, but we don't have enough for knee replacements for old people. We would never accept a similar argument on the basis of race or sex. You just wouldn't even get out the gate with that as your starting premise. We need to do the same with age. Say it's unacceptable to allocate resources according to age, period.
It's just a brief comment. When you introduced the speaker, you commented on her appearance, and I thought that was extremely bad. Ageist. I'm sorry about that.
It was meant to be. It wasn't meant serious. It was a joke.
Someone insisted to me recently that I don't look my age.
I've been told that.
And it's like, actually, this is my age. This is what I look like. What's that all about?
Yes.
My question would be to Ashton about the issue about ageism and so forth, and the anxieties that we're all hearing, these questions and comments and everything else around this whole area. How much do you think it's also, or a deeper thought, related to an anxiety about the need to be seen to be and to feel to be being productive, especially economically productive? And that's a big thing that cuts across a lot of people's reactions either way, whether they think they're wherever they are on this spectrum.
That's a really good question, and enables me to say bad things about capitalism, which is always fun. One of the very biggest asks is that we revise our notions of productivity, which are linked. And I want to imagine it's worse in the United States than here, but it's probably not. That our notion of the value of a human being is linked in a hyper-capitalist society to how much money you make and how much crud you buy. And one of the many sins of older people is they start to downsize and buy less stuff. So the forces, of course, that drive ageism are ones that commodify the changes of aging so they can sell us things to fix it, and to medicalize it so they can sell us things to cure it when it is a natural and powerful process. So it is... I have a blog post, it's about a couple weeks old, but it talks about the old age dependency ratio. Are you familiar with that term? It's the number of workers over 65 versus the under it. And, of course, the world is aging. The number of people over 65 is growing, the number of younger workers. And this is usually cast in the direst of economic terms. The World Health Organization has come out with a new index which allows for the fact that at 65, people don't fall off the cliff and cease to be, you know, become economic dead weight. I have, you know, 364 more days in which to be a productive person, and then it's all over, right? And also that younger people, you know, it's not as though everyone under 65 is productive. So these things are becoming more fluid. People, and I would like to not even say older people, people of any age, if I'm staying home and minding the children while I'm enabling my mate to go out and make money, I am part of that. If I volunteer as an older person at the school or to keep the median strips clean or whatever, that helps my community function well. So revising our notions of productivity is essential to making a world that is better for older people and better for families and better for everyone who isn't a straight white guy off to work with his, you know, wife and, you know, housekeeper from some impoverished third world country tidying up after him so that he can go make a shitload of money and get all the benefits.
More questions? This lady at the back.
What about looking at the most obvious? Once we hit a certain age, why not look at our bodies as a machine? All machines need maintenance. Our bodies need to be looked after, seriously. We have to address health issues. We have to move. We have to eat the right food. And it's our responsibility. And therefore, we go to the doctor. We are proactive to maintain our independence. So why hasn't the issue of that been mentioned, diet and exercise, etc.?
It's important to aspire to health instead of youth. And it's important to do the best we can to stay healthy. But the whole dialogue around successful aging and active aging has a huge class basis that often goes completely undiscussed. A lot of people don't have access to, you know, sushi, to personal trainers. If you have heavy caregiving responsibilities, you don't have the time to do that. You may not have the resources. And also, and I, again, I feel and I'm curious as to that the neoliberal agenda, and I suppose it's as bad here as it is in the U.S., this placing of the responsibility on the individual lets the social system off the hook. It is not my fault if there are no railings, right? And it is not my fault if I get a disease, and as we get older, physical decline is inevitable. It's also important, again, double-edged, to remember that a few diseases are conditions of old age, Parkinson's, arthritis, a couple others, Alzheimer's, but many are conditions that we set the stage for in early life, right? By not, so it's incumbent on us not just when the machine starts to break down, and it does, but from, you know, from whenever we're old enough to start taking responsibility for our own health, and that's one way to combat this narrative that, you know, you hit this old thing and then everything falls to shit, because that's not the way it works.
I read an article recently, and I wish I could remember the specifics and where I read it, but essentially it was...
You're so old.
I have to say I was taken to the doctors at 7 because I had a bad memory, and I still have a bad memory.
I have always had a terrible memory.
But no one ever blamed me for it back
exactly.
Then, and they do now.
You were having junior moments all the time.
Yes. And what had happened was they'd found this village, actually in America, a group of people who were healthier than the rest of American society, and they thought, well, let's take a look at what's going on here. And of course, the thing they looked at first and foremost was diet. They must be eating better food. Well, when they looked, they were eating Twinkies and they were eating Hershey bars and bags of crisps and all of the junk that everyone else was eating. They're like, well, it's not that, you know, what can it be? And what it came down to in the end was the fact that from where they had come from, they still had the social construction of 3 generations in each household.
Mm-hmm.
They continued to study them. Within 10 years, they had all got their own places, and everyone was living in isolation. Mm-hmm. And these people were ill. They had heart attack. They had diabetes. Mm-hmm. And they had become as ill as everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I think that part of it is capitalist construct of our of the way we are is like when you're 18, leave home, get away from your parents, go and live in
isolation. If everyone has their own house and their own little economic unit and their own car and their own washing machine and all of that.
Yeah. And then they have to pay for childcare because they can't go to work. I mean, and then and there's a
social
wealth.
Connection is the single most important variable in aging well. And I think back to the issue of being responsible for ourselves, we overlook genetics is only responsible for about 30% of your health outcome. People overlook luck, whether it's geopolitical forces or whether you break your hip or, you know, these we are all hostage to these things, and we need to look out for each other. And instead of comparing ourselves to, well, I look younger than she does, and, you know, I did my PT, so I'm more virtuous. That's just not the best way to think about it.
It's me again.
Maggie.
And I'm 85 and proud of it. But the one thing where I argue with you slightly is you use the word work to compare with earning money. I still work very hard. I've just written one book. I've started another. I run summer schools. I teach writing. I don't get paid for it, but it's work. And I wonder why you always equate work with money.
I will say that's a slip of the tongue. There is a the section in the book that says unpaid work is work. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.